digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
This is Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher, where Kevin and his guests dig a little deeper into today's issues surrounding the environment, farming, gardening, and food.
So, you know, one of the goals of Digging in the Dirt is to invite guests on the airwaves to discuss meaningful, positive solutions and to talk about how we can deal with some of the serious environmental problems that face mankind, trying to do something about that situation instead of just complaining about it. So today, my guest on Digging in the Dirt is Executive Director Adam Sachs of the Biodiversity for a Livable Climate. Of Biodiversity for a Livable Climate's mission is restoring ecosystems to reverse global warming. Adam has had careers in education and holistic medicine and politics and advocacy. For 5 years, he directed a nonprofit that worked with communities invoking basic democratic and constitutional principles to oppose detrimental local corporate activity. He has also been a climate activist since 1999, and his primary goal is regeneration of biodiversity. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Could you explain then what the organization's about?
We are an educational nonprofit. We were founded in 2013. Our mission is to change the climate conversation, to start talking about eco-restoration, the restoration and regeneration of billions of acres, that's billions with a B, around the world that have been desertified by mismanagement, and bringing back photosynthesis to all of that acreage, which only has benefits. It's inexpensive, it's local, it brings back food and healthy local economies and biodiversity and employment, and it reduces or sometimes eliminates floods and droughts. It's just nature's package deal. So it should be a no-brainer, but given the way world politics go, it needs a major marketing job.
It sounds like a really big project. How are you making inroads into changing attitudes?
We're an educational organization, so we ourselves don't do projects on the ground, but we have connections with many people around the world who are doing such projects, and it's our job, at least in part, to promote their work to a much wider audience. And to that end, we've put on 9 conferences in the past 2.5 years. We've put out a collection of papers called The Compendium of Scientific and Practical Findings, Supporting Eco-Restoration to Reverse Global Warming. That's quite a mouthful for the title of a collection of papers, called the Compendium for short. But it has a lot of information about what I call the new science and the new practical understandings of how land and biology actually works. The history of climate science is that for the most part, climate scientists are physical scientists, and they study physics and chemistry, and they've done a great job in assessing the physical and chemical aspects of climate. But they're not biologists, so they don't understand the power of biology to affect the way climate unfolds. They understand that climate disturbance certainly affects the biology. So when you have these storms and this extreme heat, you're affecting how plants are able to grow, how people are able to live their lives, and all the species in between. But we don't talk about how plants and animals and bacteria and fungi and all the rest of the creatures on the tree of life, about how those biological processes actually affect the climate. So if you cut down your trees, you're cutting down your rainfall. If you want rain to come back, you grow trees. You grow plants, because plants evaporate a lot of water, and they also give out small molecules, small chemical biomolecules that are what are called condensation nuclei, and the moisture that's up in the atmosphere comes down as rain once it condenses. And if you don't have the plants to put the water up and you don't have them to put the condensation nuclei up, the water, whatever water's up there, just doesn't fall down. It just stays up there and kind of takes a look. But we don't get it to nourish our soils and for our own well-being, for drinking and other things. So there's a very complex and fascinating and hopeful relationship there between the biology and the climate. And in fact, we look at climate as primarily a challenge of biology and not so much a challenge of reducing emissions. Reducing emissions, of course, is important. We should do that as much as possible. And our track record isn't so good. And even if we go to zero emissions tomorrow, we'll still have many of these processes in place that are causing all kinds of problems with melting ice and wildfires and all that sort of stuff. So we want to bring back a vital biology for so many reasons. And finally, the good news about it is it's cheap and it's local and it's very low tech or no tech, and people can do it in ecosystems all over the world.
So give me an example. Give our listeners an example of what you're talking about as maybe a successful project somewhere in the world that you know about.
Oh, yeah, there are many. We had a Restoring Water Cycles Reverse Global Warming Conference in 2015. We had a rancher and a fisheries biologist from northeastern Nevada. They are in the Elko area. The rancher needed more water and grasses for his animals, and the fisheries biologist wanted to see the trout come back to the Great Basin. And they work together on this project. Now, Nevada gets less rainfall than anywhere in the United States. It's less than 10 inches a year as a state. And rainfall is key to the regeneration of any ecosystem. You don't need a lot of rainfall, but you do need to keep the water in sight. Wherever water falls, that's where it should stay. And it should sink in the ground. It shouldn't evaporate or run off. So the rancher, his name is John Griggs, started doing a form of ranching called holistic management, which was developed by a wildlife biologist named Alan Savory, who has gotten some renown and I might say notoriety since his TED talk in 2013. But John tried this approach, and this was like 25 years ago at this point. And after a few years, the water started coming back. And this is because when you manage cattle in a particular way, the way nature intended, which is in relatively close, tight herds where they are grazing and they are fertilizing and they are stirring up the soil for a day or two at a time, and then it doesn't smell so good anymore, and they move on and they do it again. And meanwhile, what they've left behind is a feast for the soil life, and everything regenerates and gets even better. So John was managing his cattle this way, which is very different from the conventional way they do it in the West, where they have these fences and the animals can eat whatever they want, and they just eat what they like, and they chew down and keep trampling the same spot over and over again, which is called overgrazing, and eventually turns what was a vital grassland into desert. So John was using holistic plant grazing, and after about 15 years, the streams were coming back, the ponds were coming back, the grasses were growing, and all of a sudden, the beavers showed up. They heard the water running, and they decided it was time to explore further, and beavers, of course, are nature's primary hydrological engineers. They bring all kinds of life and biodiversity to the areas where they they manage the streams and create large ponds with many different forms of life and deep water areas, 8 to 10 feet deep, because that's what they need for protection from predators. And everything took off. So now if you look at our video, you can go to our website. All of our videos are online. If you look for John Griggs or Carol Evans, you can see the results of their work. You can see the before, which is just bare desertified land, and the after, where now they have perennial streams and ponds. After 5 years of the worst drought in memory, where other ranchers are having to truck in water on these big tanker trucks, John has this oasis in the middle of the desert. It's blue and it's green, and there's all kinds of animals and birds and biodiversity there, and it's all because of the way they manage the land. It's not rocket science. The extent to which we will be able to understand it is limited because nature is so complex, but we do understand how to manage it, and we can manage it very, very well. And this form of grazing has taken place in, it started in Africa, it's been in the southeastern United States. The National Resource Conservation Service, which is part of agriculture, has taught ranchers in the region how to do it. It's part of what we're starting to call regenerative agriculture, and it's happening in many places. So we're about educating people about these kinds of activities and helping people learn about it. And we've only been doing conferences for 2.5 years, but we've heard from people all over the world how the information is helpful to them and how they get projects started. And so that's our job. And so, all of this is bringing carbon down from the atmosphere and into the ground. Every time you see something green, that was carbon dioxide that used to be in the atmosphere that is transformed through the magic of photosynthesis into sugars and starches and is the basis for the land-based food chain.
We're talking to Adam Sachs. He's the executive director of Biodiversity for a Livable Climate. And the website he was talking about is bio4climate.org. Bio4climate.org if you want to go over there and see some of these videos and also read a little bit more about what Biodiversity for a Livable Climate does. The stuff you're talking about, is that considered eco-restoration or is it geoengineering or is it that one and the same? Could you explain a little bit about what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's you're pressing a button there, you realize. The geoengineering button, and that's it's a very interesting kind of discussion. But in terms of what we do, I would call that eco-restoration because it is just promoting and expanding on what nature does. Some people call it, to a certain extent, is biomimicry. It's doing... taking the processes that nature uses to improve soils, improve water cycles, and a variety of other things that we need to do to address climate. Just a word about water cycles. Water is the great planetary air conditioner. So when water evaporates, it absorbs a lot of heat. It's called latent heat. In order to turn liquid water into vapor requires a lot of energy, and that is energy that's absorbed on the level of the surface of the planet, whether it's in trees or whether it's on the ground. And that heat is carried with the water vapor to the upper atmosphere, where it gets cold and condenses again and releases that heat far away from the surface of the Earth. So we have major air conditioner going on here, and we have to just get back to using it properly. The example of that is that when you're in the desert, you see these temperature extremes from day to night, and that's because there's no water there. Water is a major heat buffer. So if we want to avoid these droughts and these heat extremes, we need to get the water cycle working again. I mean, that's one of the main problems that we've seen, is that the water on land is rushing off to the oceans, and it just doesn't come back the way it needs to because we've cut down so many plants and trees. This is all connected. It's a remarkable process, but we know how to fix it. So that's what we had to do. And I think I missed part of your question.
Oh, well, can you? No, I think you answered that. I saw on your website, it says, when we start to understand how the natural world functions as complex systems, only then will we grasp what we need to do. And so I think people who listen to the show and also in general understand that it's better to let Mother Nature do it the way Mother Nature does it. But you're talking on grander scales. Are you trying to get a lot of little guys to do this, or are you want some big players also? And if that's so, are governments listening? Are corporations listening? Or what's your tactic here?
Well, many things in nature happen locally. And those are the cycles that we can best understand, particularly because when you're talking about farmers and ranchers, they really care for their land. And in order to take good care of your land, you have to watch it very closely. There are no formulas there because everything is changing all the time. So you have to understand it and watch it. So to that extent, the actions have to be local. But there's a larger context in which those actions happen too, and that is an economic and ecological context that encourages this kind of behavior on the land. So large-scale industrial agriculture is not going to work for this. When you scale up that way, you simplify complex systems. Humans have to simplify when we get bigger, because otherwise there's too much to manage. So instead of looking carefully at the land, we have these large machines that do wholesale seeding and harvesting and spraying, none of which is ecologically necessary to grow food. And in fact, the food that is grown organically is much more resilient than food that is grown industrially. Industrial food requires huge amounts of inputs. And if you talk to farmers and ranchers who have changed their ways, who were educated in industrial agriculture modes and found that they're going bankrupt because they're paying so many hundreds of thousands of dollars a year for synthetic inputs, they will say that it was really difficult to change because we didn't know where we were going. But we were backed up against the wall. It was either change or sell the farm. And so they went out and tried new things. And they discovered that they didn't need all those pesticides and all those fertilizers and all those insecticides and herbicides. They needed the kind of diversity that nature provides for growing things. We can steer that diversity into agricultural methods that meet our needs as a species, but we cannot ignore and destroy the context in which that happens, as we do with industrial agriculture.
It seems a tall order. I mean, I totally buy in what you're saying, and people who listen to this program, we've had many guests on here talking about healthy soil and changing all this stuff, but I'm trying to get at
this. How do we actually do it?
Hey, exactly. You know, especially in the face of this, you know, an EPA that's hostile to this kind of concept, a president that's hostile to this concept, and just generally a huge corporate machine that's hostile to these concepts.
That is, at this point in history, a perennial question. Part of my personal assessment and view of it is that it is so unsustainable that it will simply collapse of its own weight. And what we have to be ready to do is come in with these nature-friendly methods for doing agriculture and now agroforestry, in which trees are mixed in with perennial and annual crops. And animals are also mixed in. I mean, this is the way nature does it.
Right.
And it turns out we can be very productive. And the permaculture people have made terrific progress with showing how to intensively manage food, as well as capture water and turn barren lands into vital biodiverse landscapes.
Okay, so it looks like you're saying need is going to be the engine that drives this change.
Yes. Yes. It's going to be the necessity of invention, according to the rules of Mother Earth. Because nature doesn't argue. Nature just does. And we can either get with the program or not.
Right.
The program is clearly failing. You know, global warming is a poster child for runaway technology. And poor agriculture practices are the foundation of the runaway technology that we're experiencing with climate.
Mm-hmm.
We were losing carbon to the atmosphere 10,000 years ago as a result of plowing. And so, no, we didn't know then. There's a lot we didn't know along the way. But we do know it now. We know how to do it. And it's true that there's a lot of obstacles that the current government puts forth on the one hand. On the other hand, there are farmers on their own lands, on thousands of acres of land, for some of them, 10 acres for others. But they're making this switch because it's very clear to them that it's not working. And we're getting scientific evidence and practical evidence that really supports what we're doing. And I just put in a plug for a paper that we recently published. It's called A Compendium of Scientific and Practical Findings. I think I mentioned it before. That is a collection of the scientific literature and the literature from practitioners and land managers that provides compelling evidence for doing the very kind of agriculture and land management that we need to do to reverse global warming, as well as to feed ourselves, as well as to feed the biodiversity. We're not here alone. We survive as a species only because there are so many thousands, if not millions, of other species who are playing a role in our ecosystems. And recently, there's been a lot more studying about microbes and microbiomes in the gut and in the soils. I mean, when I was a kid, the only good microbe was a dead microbe. Well, without microbes, we're dead.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much a part of our immune system and our digestive system and our neurological system that we had no idea until just a few years ago when this material started coming out. I mean, there were people who had an idea, but there were really nobody was listening. And now we're starting to listen more because things are falling apart. What we've been doing hasn't been working. So in answer to your question, which is a widespread concern, how do we do this in the face of all of these obstacles that the Donald Trumps and the Scott Pruitts and, you know, and their cohorts around the world are putting up? Monsanto and Cargill, I don't know if I'm allowed to mention them on the radio, but I did.
It's quite all right here.
People are doing it, and they're going to do it no matter what. Because what we're currently doing just isn't working. It's completely unsustainable. The only way we're going to make it is if we do a serious change. Climate is accelerating faster than anybody ever imagined. And I talked to climate scientists over the years, and they won't listen. And now they're finally starting to come around. I mean, Jim Hansen is talking about the effects of biology. He's not with the program the way I would see it at this point, but he's getting there because what we've been doing just isn't working.
So we're speaking to Adam Sachs. He's my guest today on Digging in the Dirt. He's the Executive Director of Biodiversity for a Livable Climate. And you can get information about the organization at bio4climate.org, bio4climate.org. And Adam, I'd like to ask you, you know, I saw a thing on your site that said there's ended technological consequences and progress traps that have effectively put an end to every large-scale complex society in human history. You want to just expound a little? We have a couple of minutes here. You want to expound on that a little bit? It's sort of exactly what we've been talking about. It might be a good way to wind this up.
Right. Well, progress traps are actually a phrase coined by an archaeologist named Ronald Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, who wrote this wonderful book called A Short History of Progress. It's very readable, and it's full of insights. A progress trap is something that seems like a good idea at the time. So in the early 19th century, you poke a hole with a stick in the ground, and you get this gusher of oil, and you can do all kinds of things with the oil, and it saves the whales, and gee whiz, who wouldn't want to do it? And at that point, you have a choice about whether you keep doing it or not. If you stop doing it, well, things will be a little less electromechanical and a little more trouble. But you keep doing it, you start going down the road where you're building infrastructure around this, you're building machinery around it, and all of a sudden you depend on that infrastructure. You depend on that machinery. Your agriculture depends upon it. In fact, you can't stop it even if you want to. If we were to stop fossil fuels today, there would be millions, if not billions, of people who would starve, who wouldn't be able to get water, who would run into all kinds of problems, and that's where the whole oil addiction idea comes in. It started out as a good idea at the time, and it turned into a very deep hole. And there are all kinds of progress traps that we find ourselves in, whether it's, you know, agriculture itself was a progress trap. Hunter-gatherers, you know, some anthropologists call hunter-gatherers the original leisure society because people had to do what we would call work, maybe 2 or 3 hours a day, and the rest of the time you just go and be a human doing whatever humans do, but you don't need it to eat, and you don't need it for shelter. Food was everywhere. A very, very diverse and helpful diet in most ecosystems. I mean, we wouldn't have evolved if we didn't have food. So it was there, and when we started depending on farming, it was very productive in the long run, but it was a real trap because now we can't stop farming. We've gone far beyond the ability of hunter-gatherer provisions, of the ability of the earth to provide those provisions for 7 billion people. And we're stuck. We're stuck with these processes. And to a certain extent, regenerative agriculture and regenerative land management is figuring out how can we backstep out of these progress traps so that what we need to survive, the food, isn't gathered by a process that's also killing us. It's a paradox that is, again, clearly not sustainable.
And on your website it says, fortunately, the natural world has all the answers we need. We have only to develop the ability to see them. I like that.
And, well, thank you.
And, you know, here's the question I always ask my guests finally is, are you optimistic? Are we going to develop the ability to see them and do something about it? Are we going to drive off the cliff with all the profiteers and the naysayers, or are we going to really do something about this?
Well, we're going to try. I mean, we're trying, and there are thousands of people around the world who are trying, and you know, when you start with something like this, when you're at a crossroads like this, it seems hopeless. But the changes that I've seen in just the 3 years since we've been doing conferences and doing outreach and doing research and working on some legislation, et cetera, the change is happening very, very fast. I mean, I used to go into climate groups and say, hey, we've got to do this eco-restoration. And they say, you're annoying us, shut up, go away. We've got to sign this petition and raise this solar panel on the roof and all of that. And then a year and a half ago, I was talking to a big group of people who were planning a meeting around the Pope's visit. And I said, hey, what about nature working with us on this? And I nearly fell out of my chair, and it was the lucky thing I was on radio because nobody could see it. But it was the first time that I had heard people say, yes, we want to hear what you have to say. And since then, there are more organizations moving in this direction, saying these things, and far more people who are interested. So people come to our conferences, they're all doomy and gloomy because they don't see hopeful possibilities from emissions reductions, and we present the natural world and eco-restoration, and it opens up a whole new universe of solutions that they never knew about that are hopeful on many levels. And so, Kevin, I'd love to give you a guarantee and sign on the dotted line, but I can't.
I understand.
However, I'm hopeful. Because there are a lot of really powerful and good things happening.
Great. Well, you know, you keep up the good work in this area. You know, it takes all kinds of people doing all kinds of things in all kinds of areas.
Absolutely.
And so I encourage people, maybe you want to bio-restore your backyard or, you know, start there. Or, you know, a farmer who's doing it, encourage them and say, yeah, I'll buy your stuff. You know, that's the kind of thing I like to hear from people.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are 41 million acres of lawns in this country. That's more than acreage devoted to to corn or to wheat or to soybeans. And we can turn lawns are not productive ecosystems, but we can turn them into gardens of native plants and trees and bring back the pollinators and store water and carbon. So that we don't have these huge stormwater problems. We had a drought in Massachusetts for the past 2 years. This year is different, but Massachusetts, we get 45 inches of rain usually. That's huge. And there were rivers that were drying up because of poor land management.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. We can fix that. It's all within our ability to fix.
Amen. My guest on Digging the Dirt is Executive Director Adam Sachs of the Biodiversity for a Livable Climate, and we wish you the best of luck with your efforts, sir.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
Okay,
And same to you.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
You've been listening to Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher.